You think that there is an AI bubble at the moment? Is that
massive
is that the
AI
right
bubble?
AI bubble. Okay.
Yeah. If we take seriously the fact that these companies are empires,
yeah,
we have to think about how empires have fallen in history, and every empire has fallen in history.
Is it safe to say that we're at a position right now that these companies are actually too big to bail?
Too big to bail. Oh, that's interesting. That they've pissed off a wide coalition of people.
Like, what kind of weight does he go to bed with, basically?
Elon Musk? I think that's probably what he fell asleep thinking about.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, in today's conversation, I'm joined by investigative journalist Karen Howe. In 2019, she was the first reporter to be embedded inside Sam Altman's OpenAI offices. It's a company that brought you ChatGPT, by the way. And that's because Karen has spent years tracing the rise of the AI industry, the resources behind it, the ideology driving it, and the global implications at stake. Her best-selling book, Empire of AI, isn't just a tech story. It's more about power, the rise of this new form of empire, its global impact, and the race to control and shape the future that so many of us will live in, as we all grapple with this massively disruptive force. My name is Mohammed Hashim, and this is Real Talk. And she joins us from Hong Kong. Karen Howe, thank you so much for coming on Real Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
I've been really looking forward to this conversation, Karen, so I'm ready to get into it. Thank you for making the time.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much. I know I've been a scheduling hassle, so.
No. Don't worry about it. We're just glad that you're here. Glad that I have you. Karen, I think just in a kind of, I guess if you're, I know you've had such a busy press tour with the book, but if you had time to kind of look back and stuff, because you started, you actually started in Silicon Valley. And had you, you know, stayed on that course, I think you would have had a different trajectory than the one you have now. But do you ever think about that? Do you ever think about staying that course?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, I think all the time about how if I had stayed in the tech industry, there is a high likelihood that either I would have joined the effective altruism movement or I would be working at OpenAI.
Right.
Because I think I don't.
Would you have been a boomer or a doomer? And would you have been a boomer? Or
yeah,
doomer?
Right. Like, I don't know. I mean, I probably would have been. Yeah, no, I actually don't know. Because the thing that I have a lot of empathy for the people that work within the tech industry, and I do try in my work, even though it is very critical of the industry, I do try to continue to humanize the people within it. And part of the reason is because I don't think that I would have made different choices had I stayed within the industry. Because when you are working within this environment and all of the people that you love and that you respect and that are incredibly brilliant around you, when they're all moving in a particular direction, like, who are you to think like, oh, I'm going to move in another direction, you know? And I have plenty of friends or acquaintances that have gone to work for companies like OpenAI, and then just you see them start to adopt the values and the language and the worldview of that organization, because that is the water that they swim in. And I don't think I would have been different if I had been in that environment. But I think I was, maybe I had the privilege, you could say, of having a very informative experience as my very first startup that I worked for in Silicon Valley that gave me an education in what the real incentives of the Valley are, which is that ultimately it produces profitable technologies, irrespective of whether those technologies benefit the public. And because of that experience, that is what then made me question if I wanted to be part of the industry at all and made me exit it. But if I hadn't had that experience, you know, like, I could still be there. I could be flowing with the course of the river and end up exactly where all of these people that I cover are.
Do you remember that moment? Do you remember that moment where you're like, you know what? I actually want to switch gears here. I want to get into journalism.
There were a couple moments, and all of them were very scary.
Sure. Yeah. No, I totally get that.
Yeah, because I had just graduated from studying engineering for 4 years, thinking that I was setting myself up for a lifelong career in tech. And when it occurred to me that this was not, in fact, panning out as the industry that I wanted to be a part of, I was worried that I had made fundamentally the wrong decisions in like where I went to college and what I studied. I thought I had potentially wasted 4 years and a boatload of my parents' money to ultimately pursue a totally different path. And so it was kind of a series of realizations where the first realization was, oh, I'm not quite jibing with what I'm being asked to do at this company, but sometimes they ask me to write blog posts and I really like writing. Oh, crap. Like, that is not what I studied to do. And then, wow, like people get paid to write when they're journalists. Oh, like, was that what I was supposed to study? And then like, oh my God. So the moment that I got my education was, I was at a startup where the CEO gets fired by the board. Things come full circle in that I then end up writing a book about a CEO that gets fired by his board. But they fired him in this instance, in my case, because
And it was an offshoot of Google, I think, right? Like the startup.
It was a spin out of Google. Yeah, that's right. Spin out of Google and had inherited a lot of Google's culture. And yeah, the board fired him because he was not making money. And they installed a new CEO that then started wildly pivoting the company in different ways to try and get money. He pivoted the company so far away from the original mission that it wasn't even in, you know, the same industry anymore by the time he was done pivoting in terms of this. They originally was building software for architecture firms to improve their sustainable building design. And then I don't even remember where it ended up, but it was very, very far away. And that was very like a big shock to the system because the CEO was like a big mentor of mine. It then created a lot of instability at the company where I really adored all the coworkers that I worked with and they started leaving in droves. And that was the moment then when I was like, okay, if there's any time for me to make a career switch as dramatic as jumping from a highly lucrative industry into an extremely impoverished one, I should probably do it now. So then a little over a year into working in tech, I switched into an unpaid internship in journalism.
Right. And then you were more interested in climate change in the beginning, or like reporting on the environment. And then you kind of drifted towards AI. And we're gonna go back and forth on that a little bit. But even before we get into it, there's a lot of talk in the news right now, in the news cycle, about the AI bubble. And, you know, I don't want to get too economical in my approach, but just on the general, in the general sense, right? These big tech companies, right? The Magnificent Seven, as they're called. They make up what? Like a third of the S&P 500. And they're all heavily invested in AI, for lack of a better word. But like, when again, actually, let me ask you this. Do you think that there is an AI bubble at the moment? Is that
the right? Massive AI bubble.
AI bubble. Okay.
Yeah.
And this is because of just how much money we've thrown into AI?
And how little money is being received in return for that investment. Yeah, so like OpenAI is one example. So OpenAI is actually, you know, it's actually not part of the Magnificent Seven because it's a private company, not a public one. But like a lot of the public ones are, their fates are also hitched to OpenAI. Like NVIDIA is investing huge amounts in OpenAI to in part to keep OpenAI afloat. But OpenAI has committed $1.4 trillion of spending over the next few years for building out all of the computational infrastructure that it needs to train and host its models. Right. It's generated at most two tens of billions in revenue. And that's a lot of revenue, but it's like way off from 1.4 trillion.
And I mean, there's the last stat that I checked for ChatGPT, at least, is that there's 800 million users and only 5% of those are paid subscribers.
Yes, and that roughly matches. There was this study out of Stanford University looking at consumer behavior and how many people are willing to pay for this technology. And they also found that it was roughly between 3 and 5% of people that are willing to pay versus just use the freemium product. And so OpenAI has tried a couple of different strategies already to figure out how to plug this massive gap between spending and income. And the subscriber model is already looking like it's not going to be the main driver of revenue. So they're setting themselves up for an advertising play. That's why they have added an algorithmic feed to ChatGPT. They've generated this AI-generated TikTok so that they can insert ads into the feed. But the most successful advertising business in history is Google. And last year, Google didn't even reach $300 billion in ad revenue. That's still not $1.4 trillion. And so then where are they going to close the rest of the gap? That's why we're now seeing OpenAI start generating all of these different products and releasing products on a kind of sporadic calendar, where they released Atlas, a new browser. They announced that they want to build hardware. They created Sora 2 with the TikTok-like app. But
scary as shit about Sora 2. Yeah, the videos that have come out from that.
Right. I mean, just putting aside like the societal damage that Sora 2 is wreaking, just looking at it as like a commercial venture, it's been a flop, because both Atlas and Sora 2 went viral for a blip, and then immediately the user numbers have been falling. So OpenAI has not found, like, they're not finding a commercialization strategy that's sticking, that actually can fulfill this massive gap and make up for all of the spending commitments that they have. And NVIDIA is one of the companies that's now backstopping the spending. And like Oracle has hitched itself to OpenAI's fate as well by being one of the companies that's trying to build out this infrastructure and is itself taking out debts to build that infrastructure. All of this is riding on the idea that this technology is ultimately going to generate those returns on investment. And it's simply not showing up.
So where's the money coming from?
It's coming from borrowing. Like, Altman has said that they need to develop creative financing instruments in order to keep funding the AI growth. It already sounds bad when you're talking about creative financing instruments. That's like a euphemism for basically like trying to shake more money out of corners of the economy where they usually should not be coming from, right? And so he's like he's taking debt from banks. He's raised a ton of private money from venture capitalists who are ultimately drawing upon people's retirement funds and university endowments. He's also gone to universities themselves to ask if the endowments would be willing to invest in his company. So it's coming from like all of these different places. That means that when the bubble pops, like the ripple effects will be across the global economy.
Right. And Altman has been credited with being very good at this fundraising stuff, right? Like he's been credited with being very good at this financial engineering, if you will.
Yeah, he's singular when it comes to fundraising. And it really comes down to the fact that he is extremely good at understanding human psychology, understanding what makes someone tick, and then motivating them to do what he wants them to do, which is sometimes giving him money and sometimes joining his venture to be like a talented engineer or whatever at a startup that he wants them to be at. And he's really good at telling stories as well, like painting these sweeping visions of the future that people want to be a part of. And that's why he's been such a successful fundraiser, even when the financial picture of this company is rather bleak.
And we're talking about, you said just a minute ago about the implications on the economy. And I think just to, again, put it in perspective for viewers, we talked about NVIDIA. So NVIDIA is worth more than the economy of Japan at the moment. The Magnificent Seven, the big seven tech companies, are probably worth the same amount as China's economy at the moment. And so I think for viewers to kind of understand, if this AI bubble pops, you know, even if it has a hiccup, I think that I guess the implications of it are going to be huge and devastating on the global economy. I mean, because I think of like 2008 and what happened, and then the U.S. government bailed out the banks. I think, is it safe to say that we're at a position right now that these companies are actually too big to bail?
Too big to bail. Oh, that's interesting. I'm just wondering.
You're right. But in my head, I'm like, well, okay, 2008, the U.S. government were, you know, they bailed them out. They bailed the banks out. And so that was kind of their life jacket. But because of how massive these tech companies are, let's say something happens like an AI bubble bursting. Are we going to be able to see the U.S. government even being able to bail them out?
That's a really great question. I actually haven't thought about this at all. Yeah, I don't know. But I mean, like, you see the companies trying to make maneuvers to set themselves up for a government bailout should there be a burst. And there's kind of two ways that they've been doing this. One, I mean, the CFO of OpenAI, Sarah Friar, let slip at an event at one point that they thought the government should be backing OpenAI's debts. And then Altman did a walk back on Twitter saying, no, we never mentioned that. And then there was reporting that found that actually OpenAI has been to some degree socializing this idea with the government. But beyond that, there was this really amazing analysis from this economics reporter, Kyla Scanlon, who writes her own Substack, where she pointed out that in addition to literally trying to socialize with the government, this idea of a bailout, I think the Trump administration is also understands that there is a symbiotic relationship right now between itself and the crazy stock market floating on AI stocks. Because when the stocks float, which the stocks are floating only because of the AI stocks, all other non-related AI stocks are falling. It's a K-shaped economy. It provides a veneer that the economy is still doing well. And that is the only cover that the Trump administration currently has to continue following through on its political agenda and like sending ICE into the streets and the, military into the streets. And so there's also a degree of like, the Trump administration is relying on these AI companies to provide it the political cover to do shady things. And that is also what is making these companies too big to fail. But whether they're too big to bail, Kyla Scanlon's analysis.
The point that you're making about the U.S. government relying on these companies, that's actually very interesting because there's been a lot of, there's a lot of stuff happening in the news. So we've seen Trump the last I read was he was preparing an executive draft in the sense of like blocking states from regulating AI. So clearly he doesn't want AI to be regulated in the U.S. But then there was the other thing related to Mission Genesis, which is related to how the government is going to be, or the federal government is going to actually start, is it launching their own AI initiatives or basically giving up a lot of the federal data to be used in AI projects? But I guess even beyond all that, the question that the reason why I said it was interesting is because there's been a lot of talk, and you highlight this in your book, about AI being an extension of the US empire or just empires in general.
Yeah. So interestingly, I don't think, so I think Silicon Valley and the U.S. government are two separate empires that exist on American soil. Yeah. So Silicon Valley, they're the corporate empires, and then the U.S. government is the nation state empire. And the way that I see them relating right now is essentially the relationship between the British East India Company and the British Crown back in the day.
Yes, that was it. Yeah.
British East India Company was engaging in its own imperialism, violence, colonization in various territories. And it got to a point where it then needed a bailout. And that is when the British Crown nationalized the company and then India officially became a colony of the United Kingdom, of the British Empire. And I think this similar dynamic is playing out right now, where we don't know at the moment who's going to bail out whom.
Who's using who? Okay.
But they're both trying to use one another. Like Silicon Valley, that empire is trying to use the American empire to strike all these deals all around the world at a faster pace than perhaps they might have been able to do, because the head of state is able to give them access to rooms faster than they might have been able to get access to. But in the other way around, the US, like the Trump administration, is absolutely trying to rebuild the American empire as well and sees Silicon Valley as state assets. They see the installation of American hardware and software all around the world, or Silicon Valley hardware and software all around the world, as the installation of American hardware and software. I actually don't think that is true, but that's what the Trump administration thinks. And they think that as long as they can control the industry and keep them as kind of at the behest of the American empire, that is then going to help with their imperial agenda. But they're not actually aligned. Like, they're each trying to use the other and subsume the other. But what I think we are starting to see the beginnings of is potentially just the replaying of what happened with the British East India Company and the British Crown, which is that these corporate empires are in fact very weak at their foundations, and they are realizing that maybe they need to start orienting themselves for a bailout. And then maybe indeed they will become, you know, assets of the state, because the US government is going to do whatever the equivalent of nationalizing these companies are, which they're weirdly enough already starting to do with a lot of companies. They're taking stakes in a lot of different companies in a way that the government hasn't really done before.
And where do you see this going in terms of these?
You know, either way, like regardless of which empire wins, it would all be a bad scenario, because it's returning to the age of empire, which is the erosion of democracy and freedom and agency of people to self-determine their futures around the world. So I do not think that we should in any way be heading back to the place that we left decades ago, which is a few people at the top affecting billions of people around the world with their decisions based on not accountability to those people, but just like their whims and their egos and waking up on the wrong side of the bed in the morning. So yeah, like I think that is, if we do not prevent these companies from doing this imperial expansion, and if we do not hold them accountable, like that is what would happen.
And you're talking about the people, and this is something, again, interesting to get into, because you actually went to university with a lot of these executives, right? You went to university with a lot of these senior executives that surround these big CEOs, tech CEOs. Do you think they know how much is at stake when it comes to creating these products that are basically ripping at the fabric of society?
I don't think that they're within their worldview and value system, what they think is at stake is very different from what like the average person thinks is at stake. And I do think that some of the people within these companies believe that difference in perception of what's at stake is a measure of intelligence. Like I think some of these people think that they are inherently smarter than the other people, and that's why they see a different set of stakes. So like the average person who is thinking about their job security and their economic future, who's thinking about just being able to pay their utility bills, being able to access clean air and clean water, wanting to know that they can protect their kids from mental health harms, wanting to know that their future generations aren't going to be scorched by climate change. Like, those are not the things that a lot of these employees at these companies worry about. I also don't want to paint them all with the same brush, because like these are large organizations and there are many different positionalities within the companies, but among the senior leadership.
And there's people in these companies that truly believe that they are working for the betterment and for the good of humanity.
A huge portion of them. A huge portion of them believe. And like, but yeah, so for people who are senior and have been at these companies for a long time, I think they have bought into this narrative that what's at stake is actually whether or not civilization gets to progress to the next stage. And for them, this is about like the idea that they are building artificial general intelligence, this theoretical AI system that achieves human level intelligence. And that when you suddenly have human level digital intelligences that can then multiply, replicate, you can have armies of human level digital intelligence like all around the world, that this is either going to bring a profound utopia or it's going to bring the devastation of humanity because the people that created the digital intelligences first were actually evil. And so for them, that's what's at stake. So it's like a completely different, it's like a perpendicular set of stakes from the average person. And like, I'm very critical of the people who buy into these theoretical stakes because they're theoretical. Like, we have literally no there's no scientific backing of any of these ideas that they have. You know, 75% of AI researchers surveyed this year said that we're not on the path to AGI. They don't know if we can ever get to AGI. AGI is completely undefined because we don't even have scientific consensus around what human intelligence is. So like, how are we even creating a system that might have human intelligence? We can't even benchmark whether we've gotten there or not. And then there's so many questions around like, what does it mean if that happens? We have no idea. And yet like they've represented the stakes of this game in their minds around all of these philosophical and theoretical notions rather than like the real world evidence of what is happening all around us right now, which is that there are people around the world actively being harmed by this technology, actively having their futures taken away by this technology. And that is what we should be focused on solving.
Well, you know, I want to try to see if I can get what other people are thinking when it comes to AI and its future and the threats of it and all that. But I think it may sound like a simple question, but I do think people are asking this in the sense of like, well, if we created it, can't we just pull the plug if it gets too dangerous?
Yeah, I mean, yes. Like, I mean, this is in the minds of people who think that the answer is no, like the digital intelligence will develop consciousness and go rogue and then be too clever for us to stop whatever.
There's people arguing that it's gonna lead to the extinction of the human race.
Yeah, like all of these ideologies are, I can only describe as none of them have any backing. Like they've all been cultivated, you know, in the bubble that is Silicon Valley, where a bunch of extremely rich, privileged people are talking with one another about like the possibilities of one day being able to control every possible facet of life and society, including avoiding their own death. Like that's like that's where these ideologies about AI are also, they're coming from the same seed. So they're talking about, oh, like maybe AI will develop these AI gods that are going to inherit the earth from us, or they're going to, you know, extend whatever it is. It's just like, I cannot stress enough that like it comes from this like very niche and specific and extremely narrow worldview that is cultivated under circumstances that just do not match reality around the world. And again, it's like, it's hard when you're surrounded by people that are brilliant and kind and thoughtful and whatever, that are all thinking in this way, to not think this way yourself. And so like, this is how the ideology then proliferates and grows and gets more adherence, is that more and more people join the companies, more and more people become indoctrinated by these mythologies and then kind of forget that it was a mythology in the first place.
Oof. I mean, Karen, you're just laying these heavy things on me. And I'm supposed to navigate. But let me take you back to 2019, because you were, you know, the catalyst for your book is that you were the first reporter to be embedded within OpenAI. And to cover it. Now, your first brush with the senior executives around Sam Altman, because you met quite a few, I want to get the first impression you got when you sat down for the conversation and you just started asking questions.
The first meeting that I had was with Greg Bachman, chief technology officer at the time, and Ilya mm-hmm. Sutskever, chief scientist at the time. And Sam Altman was actually not really in the picture, because he technically had just become CEO, but he was barely at the office, and it was really Greg and Ilya that were running the day-to-day. I just asked Greg and Ilya simple questions, which was like the first one that I asked was, oh, why invest billions of dollars in developing AGI rather than just using those billions of dollars to like solve climate change or eradicate poverty? Like the things that you say that you're building AGI for. And they couldn't really articulate an answer for what propelled them to focus on this technology and what evidence they could use to substantiate that this technology was going to lead to all of the downstream positive effects that they were promising. So then I kind of reversed the question and was like, well, a big part of OpenAI's origin story is also that you feel that you need to develop this technology first before the bad actors develop bad AGI. So if we can't really quite articulate what the benefits are and how we're going to get there, what about like articulating the downsides and how we would get there if things went wrong? Hmm. And they couldn't really articulate that either.
What?
And that's when I started getting a little bit worried. And at first it
worried,
was one of those
worried
meetings.
In what sense? Was it like, these are the people that are in charge of the future? Like when you say worried, do you remember the first thought that kind of came into your head?
You know, when you have I'm sure you've experienced this yourself, like having interviewed many people, is like sometimes you sit down for an interview and you don't get any of the answers that you expect from the person. Like, it's just a very frustrating interview. And like, my first thought was, am I the problem? Like, am I just asking the wrong questions?
Yeah.
Like, what's going on? Like, why does this interview feel so like constipated? Like, I'm like, asking what I think are, you know, the most obvious questions, and they're not really answering them. So I'm like, did I miss something here? And it took me a while of just like re-listening to the recording later, like again and again and again, being like, wait a minute. No, this is the takeaway, is like, they can't even answer the most fundamental questions. It wasn't that my questions were bad. It's that they have no answers. Like, that's the problem. And so then it struck me that they're positioning themselves as fundamentally different from all the tech companies that came before. That's why they're a nonprofit. That's why they're being open to the public. That's why they're supposed to be this very collaborative institution that's willing to work with anyone and even self-sacrifice if there's another entity that starts seemingly being ahead in artificial general intelligence. Mm. They, in their original charter, they said that they would just fold OpenAI into the other organization, kind of like allow the other organization to absorb the company. And what I realized was, no, they're like literally every other tech company that came before, but maybe worse, because they are getting mountains of money without any articulated vision of what they're actually doing, which is the story of pretty much every tech company since, you know, the VC model was developed. And not only that, they don't actually have the self-awareness that that's what they're doing. So
did you ever think like, oh, we're screwed? Because that's like the first impression of me hearing your story. I'm like, oh, this doesn't sound promising at all.
I did not think, oh, we're screwed, because I didn't think OpenAI would become such a big deal.
Right.
Because it's hard to explain to people like how much of a sideshow they were at the time compared to all of the other heavy hitters. like DeepMind, Google, even Meta. Like OpenAI was like this weird stepchild where it had some reputation simply because it was co-founded by Elon Musk, who was
and it had a non-for-profit aspect.
And had a not-for-profit and had successfully recruited Ilya Sutskever, who within the AI research world was very prominent because he had already developed a number of different breakthroughs. And that was that. So like it had this kind of strange reputation where it was like, okay, has some really key people attached to it, but overall, like not actually clear whether it is a leader in this space and whether it will be a prominent player later on. And so for me, it was the realization that like this organization is not what it seems it is. The implications were more contained at the time because it was like, well, okay, yeah, so this organization is going to burn through $1 billion and then it's probably going to fold. It's going to have maybe some effects on the AI research landscape, but I did not foresee that it would become like the player that introduced the conception of AI to the public.
But here's what I don't get, Karen. I think you'll really help break this down because you talk about Musk, and Musk parted ways with OpenAI later because of his relationship with Sam Altman. And then he went on to really have this apocalyptic view of AI. You know, he was extremely critical of the consequences, and he was sounding the alarm in different media outlets. And yet now he's one of, you know, he has Grok on X and all of that. Like he's part of the game basically. And it's not just him, it's all the other big tech CEOs as well. They all kind of have a piece of the pie at the moment. But why is that? I mean, why do they go from, I guess someone like Musk, why would he go from being so apocalyptic to being like, you know what, let me be a part of this game as well?
All of the CEOs of the current crop of companies started apocalyptic and got into the game. So Musk was already apocalyptic when he started OpenAI. And Sam Altman, I mean, it's unclear whether he truly believes in the apocalyptic potential of AI, but he uses it a lot. Like he called OpenAI and continues to call OpenAI the AI Manhattan Project. For a reason, like he's trying to draw parallels with the nuclear arms race. And, Demis Hassabis, similar kind of origin story. Dario Amodei, who was an ex-OpenAI person that then left to found Anthropic, exact same origin story. And this is where there's a direct tie to why I call these companies empires of AI.
Mm.
All empires have a narrative that there is this existential race at stake.
Yes.
They are the good empire that's bringing civilizing mission to the world, bringing progress and modernity to all of humanity. And they are competing with the evil empire that could potentially lead to humanity's demise. And they, like, this like, doom and boom, it's, like, symbiotic. Like they need the doom narrative, they need the like the evil empire is going to kill us all to justify why they are the good empire that needs to stay in the game, because they must be strong enough to counter the evil empire. And all of these people conceive of each other as the evil empires, and also collectively China as the evil empire.
Yeah, because it started as Google, right? Google was the evil empire, at least from OpenAI's perspective. But now, like you said, it's shifted to China.
Yeah, exactly. And like Musk also considers OpenAI the evil empire, and Anthropic considers OpenAI the evil empire, and OpenAI considers DeepMind the evil empire. You know, like it's just all circular. Like everyone thinks that the other person is the bad guy, and that's why they must be the knight in shining armor that builds their world domination enterprise to make sure that they're the bringers of the peace. They're the bringers of utopia. They're the bringers of the AI heaven.
And what were your takeaways of Sam Altman? I know he didn't speak to you, but what did you end up after writing your book and the journey that this book has taken you on? What did you go away, or your biggest takeaways about Sam Altman's character?
I think it goes back to what I was saying about how he's just a masterful storyteller and he really understands human psychology. And so I opened the book with this quote from him where he observes about 2 years before he starts OpenAI, the most successful founders don't set out to create a company. They set out to create something closer to a religion. And it turns out that creating a company is the easiest way to do so. That to me, I think encapsulates in a nutshell, Sam Altman, his character and the role that he has played in creating the mythology around AI, AGI, OpenAI, and leading to the rapid escalation of empire building. Like, he understood what, you know, like all empires in the past understood, which is religion is a core part of imperial expansion. It justifies imperial expansion. And there's also like the, you're trying to save people's, like, if you create a narrative where you're saving people's souls, like, that's what allows you to continue, you know, rapidly proliferating, seizing resources, doing whatever it needs to do, because ultimately the ends justify the means. And also you create this kind of fervent following within the power center of the empire to not question things either. And so, yeah, like, I think Altman just understood the heart of what makes people tick and how to rally lots of people and lots of resources around a singular vision.
And why do you think he quotes Napoleon a lot?
I don't know if he quotes Napoleon a lot, but he definitely did say that there was a year when he read Napoleon's book and that was his favorite book of the year. And it's funny because he says, when he mentions this in a public talk, that he was like, I'm glad Napoleon isn't running my country because, man, that guy understands something about human psychology and something about power that I really don't, or whatever, you know. But he's, you know, he's calling out the exact characteristic of Napoleon that you can tell from his words he actually admires and actually emulates very well. So game sees game.
Real, recognize real. But you know, again, there's something interesting here because you talk about Altman being a masterful storyteller. And I think I've heard you also talk before about how he is able to kind of wear different hats depending on who he's talking to. Like, he pushes a certain narrative when he's talking to, like, the government, or he pushes another narrative when he's talking to, like, podcasters or journalists. And he's just become very good at just giving people different, I guess, narratives, is it right to say, in terms of what, is it more about what they want to hear, or how does he do that?
Yeah, it's exactly that. Like, he sort of figures out what is it that his audience needs to hear to get them to then come along with him to the next step. And you can see this in the way that he continuously defines and redefines AGI. As we've mentioned, like, AGI is a totally nebulous concept, lacks clarity. And so he can put out different definitions depending on who he's trying to persuade. When he is talking with consumers, AGI is suddenly this magical digital assistant, like in the movie Her, that seamlessly integrates into your life and brings you joy and delight and does all of the drudgery that you didn't want to do. When he's talking with the US government, he is evoking a version of AGI that's solving climate change and curing cancer and eradicating poverty and bringing economic abundance that the world has never seen. When he struck the deal with Microsoft, the information reported that AGI was defined as a system that generated $100 billion in revenue. And on OpenAI's site, AGI is officially defined as highly autonomous systems that outperform humans in most economically valuable work. These are four completely different definitions that do not have coherence. And that is just one example of the way that he wears these different hats. Like, he's able to tap into the thing that person desires. I was thinking about how this is very much like the mirror in Harry Potter, where someone looks into the mirror and see exactly what they desire. You know, I was like, that's you know, Sam Altman is, he's the mirror. Like, he just puts up that mirror and the person sees the thing that they want and kind of falls into coming along with him.
That's so interesting. This is the first I hear. I wanted to hit you back with another Harry Potter reference, but I can't. Though I do, I do have a question here, Kara. It's because I was like, oh man, she hit me with Harry Potter. I'm in the UK. This is perfect. Let me hit her back with one. But what do you think someone like Sam Altman goes to sleep worrying about? Like, genuinely, like, what is someone like that, of that caliber, in that position? What actually kind of makes him anxious? What does he go to sleep? Like, what kind of weight does he go to bed with, basically?
Elon Musk? I think that's probably what he falls asleep thinking
about. Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Like, so it really just goes back to the arms race.
Yeah. The honest answer is I don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah, of course. You're not a mind reader. Yeah. We totally get that.
Altman is he's still to me a black box, an enigma. I don't feel like I really got into his psychology as a person, even though I spoke to a lot of people that have worked with him for a long time and very closely. But just based on, people have mentioned that he's a very paranoid person. He is a very high-strung person. He doesn't appear that way in public. He's very good at concealing it. But for the people that have worked closely with him for a long time, like, they realize this over time. That there's this part in the book where I talk about how OpenAI really securitizes itself under Altman's direction after Musk leaves.
Yeah.
So he does a sweep to see if there's any surveillance bugs that Musk might have planted in the office. He starts building higher gates around the building to block people from coming in. He directs a small team to look into internal threats, insider threats, which is, you know, typical for a company. You always have to be assuming that there's external and insider threats. But it was weird at the moment of OpenAI's history, because it was still supposedly a nonprofit, but he was already like securitizing it in this way. And it was very driven by this kind of fear of, is Musk gonna be recording us, or is like someone gonna leak our secrets? Because at the time, all of the employees were whispering to each other, our secrets can be written on a grain of rice, which they meant the single word scale. And so there was like all of this fear that any moment someone's going to figure out the only thing that we're doing is just scaling existing technologies. And then we could, like, the moment Google realizes this, we could be blown out of the water, because Google has way more firepower to scale than we do. And so I think based on that, my extrapolation is that he probably spends his time continuing to think about who are the more powerful actors than him in the world that are potentially going to threaten to unseat him. Mm. And one of the few people in the world that is still more powerful than him is Musk.
Mm. And how do people push back against these AI companies? I know your book has taken you to different countries as well to kind of explore the consequences and implications of these major companies and their data centers, their supercomputers and all that. But I think of the example of the Chilean water activists, basically, who managed to kind of push back against Google. But how far do people have to go to really draw the line here? Because there are, you know, there's land implications, there's energy implications, there's water implications. There's so much that you explore and talk about. And I just kind of wanted to get into that because, again, a lot of people might not see the full picture in terms of the actual consequences of all of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the pushback, if we take seriously the fact that these companies are empires,
yeah,
we have to think about how empires have fallen in history. And every empire has fallen in history. So I am actually extremely optimistic that we will get there. But the way that every empire has fallen has been a broad coalition of resistance from all corners of society. I mean, you're trying to unseat an extremely consolidated power that is has based its power off of dispossessing all those people that are rising up to resist. And so they clearly have way more resources and they're like fortifying their castle. But we are already actually seeing this resistance starting to happen where these companies have extracted and exploited so many different groups of people that they've pissed off a wide coalition of people. They've pissed off artists and writers who they've taken their intellectual property from. They've pissed off working class communities that are getting these massive data center facilities in their towns, which has created more in the US. It's been really interesting. It's created more bipartisanship against the AI industry than pretty much anything else that has ever happened in recent memory, because the working class communities that they're going into are right-leaning, and they're also pissing off parents and families whose children are being harmed. Some of their children are dying by suicide after using these tools for a long time. They're pissing off educators who are like, we can't even do our jobs of teaching kids anymore because they keep cheating on their homework. They're also pissing off kids themselves, who many of whom are way more radicalized about needing to push back against climate change because that's their future. And so there's all of these different groups that are pushing back, and the public opinion, the global public opinion on these companies has dramatically shifted in just the last year to be much more negative, because there have been so many instances in which different communities have felt that they are now bearing the brunt of the harm. And so I think what we need to do is just continue to amplify the resistance when these companies take things that are not theirs, when they exploit people instead of engaging in a fair exchange of value. We demand better. We don't allow them to do those things. And with, you know, the majority of people around the world speaking in the same voice, the companies will have to change. And the goal, by the way, is not for these companies to go away. The goal is just for them to stop being empires. Like, they do not have to, companies do not have to exploit and extract the majority of the population to do what they do. Like, they should just be companies that are providing business and services that benefit people proportionally to what those people give them in return. So it's just like, that's the goal. That's the end state.
Yeah.
Enough pushback that these companies finally are held accountable to the broader global public that their technologies impact.
But how does that translate on the ground? Like, even thinking of two quick statistics, I mean, just the other day, there was a report that came out here in the UK that by 2035, AI could lead to 3 million job losses. And then there was another report that just said, you know, basically half of white collar entry level jobs could be wiped out by, you know, in the next 1 to 5 years. And so I guess taking that at face value, whoever is listening might just be like, well, you know, clearly AI is here to stay and it's already too big and too powerful to kind of combat, because it's already kind of all these predictions are coming out about job losses and different factors and different sectors being wiped out. So how does all of that translate on the ground?
I don't think AI is necessarily here to stay in this current manifestation. I don't think anything is ever inevitable. And I also want to make clear that, like, AI actually is an umbrella term that refers to so many different types of technologies. And particular critique that I have is against the version of AI that is these large scale models that require an extraordinary amount of training data and an extraordinary amount of computational infrastructure that is then leading to all of the labor, social, and mental health harms that we're talking about. That not every AI system has that same track record. You know, I'm very bullish on specialized, lightweight AI models that require very little training data, very little computational resource, and provide massive benefit. Like, there's this nonprofit called Climate Change AI that's actually about trying to figure out ways in which AI can improve climate change rather than accelerate climate change. And all of the AI techniques that they list have nothing to do with large-scale generative AI models. It's all like specialized AI systems, some of which are lightweight enough to train on a laptop, not on like a supercomputer that's almost the size of Manhattan, you know? So like, to me, the way that we, like, if we can disentangle AI from empire, which I think we can, like, we do not need empires to benefit from AI, then like, it becomes clear that these companies don't actually have a narrative to justify what they do anymore. And that is what's going to get people to start shifting, not only apply pressure to the companies and make them stop being reckless, but also they're going to be rallying around investing in other types of alternative AI tools. And when you have more alternatives, that is then going to lead to consumer behavior shifts, to company behavior shifts, to just more and more people starting to starting to bring to fruition and adopt different types of AI technologies that are not these large scale systems. And that's how we can get to a place where we have AI, we have the benefits of AI, but we don't have the huge wide scale harms of the version of AI that Silicon Valley is currently selling us.
Well, that's the thing, is like, what if they turn, they as Silicon Valley turn to you and say, look, if AI doesn't exist in its current manifestation, if we don't do it, China will, which we kind of got into early in the conversation. But if they just say, if we don't do it, China's going to do it. So we might as well, because we're the good empire, we might as well do it.
Yeah. And you know what's so hilarious about that argument? If we look at the track record of this argument, it has literally gotten us more Chinese open source AI models that are now being embedded within US infrastructure. Like, the US government literally used export controls to try and contain Chinese AI development. What did instead was it just created a pressure cooker in which Chinese companies innovated around those constraints and figured out how to develop models that have similar capabilities with just less cost, less computational resources. And so now they're producing all of these lighter weight open source models that are cheaper to run. Some people have also said they're just also better. They have like give high quality responses. And so all of these Silicon Valley startups are now using Chinese open source models instead of paying OpenAI or Anthropic or Google for their closed source technology. Because why would they do that? They are getting the better, cheaper version for free or cheaper to run for no startup cost. And I, like, as I've been on book tour, I've been going across the US, and you know, I'm speaking with AI researchers in academia that are all US-based AI researchers, also all using Chinese open source AI models. So it's just,
it's like an own goal, basically.
Literally. And so I'm like, clearly this argument is totally fake.
Yeah.
So we should just stop listening to it. And we should move to a different narrative where we are not in a zero-sum race to the death. There was this actually this great newsletter issue that just came out today from Kevin Xu, who writes Interconnected. He was former Obama White House and now writes this AI and geopolitics newsletter. And he was saying that like the race narrative is actually just an inaccurate way of understanding the true relationship between the US and China when it comes to AI development. And the better word is co-opetition, which is there is competition. There's also a lot of cooperation. So these like cross-border interchanges, when China sometimes borrows techniques from the US and the US is now using open source models from China. And there's also like a co-option element where they're constantly like taking the best of the best from one another. And that's actually the real picture of what's happening, is that there's just constant interchange of ideas and interchange of software, because software is much harder to control than hardware. And then there is like economic competition and there's like business competition, but that's also healthy in that you want there to be competition in the marketplace, that there's lots of different alternatives and people can choose the best product that wins. And to flatten all of that into just these two are actually at each other's throats and should be at each other's throats is neither doing justice to the real world reality of what's happening, nor is it actually leading to the U.S. ending up in a winning position.
Right. Look, I only have a few seconds left, and I'm going to ask you one last question. Although I feel like I want another hour with you to continue. But first of all, I think everybody should read your book. It's such an eye opener, and it really just makes you think about all these different factors that you may not have been thinking about previously. But what do you want people, other than reading your book, what do you want people to take away from everything that you're doing right now, in terms, which also includes the conversations that you're having, the press store, all of that?
Just the inevitability narrative is so strong. Like the number of times that I hear, oh, but AI is just here to stay. It's like, yes, but which version of AI?
Mm.
We have so much opportunity to choose which version of AI we get to have stay. And I've been so optimistic while I've been on tour that actually literally every single place that I've been, and at this point, I think I've toured in, I don't know, 36 cities or something like that, like all around the world. And Everyone is actually speaking with the same voice. And that is why I think there is genuine possibility, high probability actually, that we are going to get to a better place where we contain the empires and return back to a future where AI is supporting vibrant, healthy societies where people have individual freedoms and also collective agency to self-govern. Like that is possible because this broad base of resistance is building and people are forming all of these movements, all of these coalitions that are all pointed in the same direction of they do not want these empires anymore. And I think every single person that is listening to this, they should join in and they should reclaim that agency to be part of the resistance.
Powerful ending. And we're going to leave it here. Karen Howe, thank you so much for coming on Real Talk. Listen, the next time you're in London, we got to do this in person.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, absolutely. Thank you, Karen. It was my pleasure.